You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
The new National Domestic Abuse Register is being launched today by the Home Secretary, which aims to protect victims as well as tackling perpetrators.
Yes, it will inform women if they're sharing a home or bank account with a convicted domestic abuser.
Just to fill you in on this, two women a week are killed by a current or former partner, according to the latest statistics. Zoe Dronfield is a survivor and campaigner of domestic abuse and stalking. And she joins us now. And Zoe, we're really appreciative that you are willing to share your story with us. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Zoe, what happened to you? What was your experience of domestic abuse?
So I'd been in a relationship for about a year before he started to unravel. I then tried to end the relationship, and often this is the most difficult time in an abusive relationship. When you're trying to end it is when they up the ante. This is when the stalking started. And, you know, I ended up having to call the police. The police response wasn't great. And then, you know, the stalking escalated. I ended up meeting him and it nearly cost me my life. I was almost murdered.
And I mean, I've seen photographs of the injuries you suffered and, you know, almost too horrific to show, black and blue and terribly ill. In fact, I'm told we can show it, but I'd just like to say, anyone at home, you may...
This is disturbing.
Yeah, it is upsetting. Yeah. Let's just have a look at this image of you.
But this is Zoe. This is the way she was left by the man in her life. And that is what domestic abuse looks like. There's no point dressing it up any other way.
Exactly.
That's the basic way, Zoe. It's ugly. It is awful. It is carried out often by men who are then free to enter into other relationships. So your view on what is being proposed by the Home Secretary today, what do you think?
Well, I've been campaigning for this for the last 8 years, and actually we've got a petition that's almost reached 268,000 signatures. We've year on year tabled debates in both houses of parliament to try and get this pushed through. It was meant to be in the domestic abuse bill. It got pushed out the House of Commons. So it kind of ping-ponged backwards and forwards. But the reason I'm campaigning so heavily around this is because, you know, most abusers have done this before. It's never a one-off incident. There's often other victims. And in my situation, I found out that actually when my story broke in the media and, you know, it went in the national newspapers, I was contacted by, at the time, 13 other women that had been in a relationship with my perpetrator and had been on fast response with the police. He had also been in a relationship with a serving police officer, and he had been put in prison for harassment against her, actually, 10 years prior to me. So, you know, if they can't get it right for their own, then how are the rest of us going to do? You know, so this is something that will mean that the police have to proactively identify, assess and manage these type of offenders, which serial offenders are the most dangerous type.
And is that realistic? And I'm really hopeful that it is. But I just want to understand how this register would work, because, you know, how will police officers and the authorities know who these offenders go on to be in relationships with? Is it up to the police then to contact these women and say, do you know who this person is?
Well, we've already got Claire's Law, haven't we, where it gives victims the right to know. That's not often used as much as it should be. And I think that the you know, the outcome of this will be how it's dealt with on the ground and in the field. I haven't seen the detail of what the register looks like. What we've been asking for is that these serial perpetrators are managed by the police. So if you think about in my case, I made that first 999 call and he was stalking me at the time. So he was turning up at my house drunk. It was a school night. My children were in bed. Now, if they'd have had a flag on the police system to say, look, this is a serial offender. He has done this before. He's got other victims. I would have been flagged as a high risk. So they would have been able to manage the priority of, you know, what victims should be seen first. You know, they're dealing with huge numbers of domestic abuse calls. I was actually put as a standard risk. So, and I wasn't told about his historic offending. So I was just left, you know, to deal with the situation myself. And actually, every time I contacted the police, it was minimized. You know, I was told that, well, he hasn't really done anything yet. Even when the police came round to my house, they were making jokes saying, well, you know, you need to find yourself a nice boyfriend. Well, it, you know, this isn't funny. It isn't a joke. My life was being completely turned upside down. I wasn't able to conduct my life correctly. So, you know, it's important we put the onus back on the perpetrator to change. A lot of what we do at the moment is focused on the victim.
Yeah.
Do you believe that your perpetrator, Jason Smith, do you believe he was beating you up? Or he was trying to murder you?
Well, I mean, he was trying to murder me. When I came round at the side of the bed and you saw the picture earlier, I mean, I'd been stabbed in the neck. I've got stab wounds in the back of my hand, defence wounds. You know, I was beaten, stamped. He stamped on me with shoes on. And when I came round, you know, halfway through the attack or whenever it was, you know, He was chopping at his wrists with a meat cleaver saying, we're going together, babe. I mean, you know, that gave me an adrenaline rush. I don't know what happened. I kind of, woof, I needed to get out of there. I knew I was going to be killed. And I pleaded with him for my life and said, you know, I've got children, please, Jason, call me an ambulance. And eventually he did. But this was like an 8-hour, you know, ordeal.
How do you, after that, learn to trust a man again? How do you learn to love again? Have you been able to?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in a relationship for the last six years now. So, you know, I was raised by my father, who's a good man. And, you know, I've got a son. I don't think that all men are like that. And I don't label every man like that. And, you know, there are some really lovely men in my life and men that have supported me throughout my campaigning, you know, people that I work with, you know, people in government, yourself, Amy, you know, there's many good men out there. It's abusers that we need to focus on.
This register does exactly that. It seems to be the right idea that these people commit the crime, they should be known for it, and other people should be warned about them. So we an absolute privilege to listen to you, and just very humbled thank to listen you. To you yeah. as
what
well.
A, what a strong woman you are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome back to Crime Analyst in the Intelligence Cell. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, somebody who I've worked with for a very long time. And in one sense, I'm saddened to be talking to you again, Zoe, but it's a very important conversation that we need to have. So please introduce yourself.
Hi. Yeah, thank you, Laura. I'm really pleased to be here, but not for the reasons why we are. I'm Zoe Dronfield, and in 2014, I was almost murdered by my ex-partner, who is a serial perpetrator.
Yes, 2014, February the 14th, so Valentine's Day. I often talk about dates and that things happen on those dates for particular reasons. And you were attacked. It was a horrific attack by someone called Jason Smith. And I would encourage everybody to go back and listen to my interviews with Zoe, episodes 51 to 53. I called it Preventing Murder in Slow Motion, and we talked about exactly what happened step by step and how you met each other right up until that attack happened, but also the aftermath of it. And I don't want to have you go through everything again, which is why, because it's re-traumatizing, quite frankly. You know that, I know that. But for my listeners, please do go back and listen to Zoe's story. We've been talking together for a very long time and we've become friends. We've been working on a campaign together to ensure that serial perpetrators like Jason Smith are proactively identified by the police, prison and probation service, so that we don't have a situation, which is what happened with you, where you have at least 18 women, some of whom had reported to police, not all of them, but many of them had, and the police hadn't joined up those dots. They hadn't looked at his offender history when you first called them out. And we want to avoid that from happening. We want to make sure that the police are proactive, but also they talk with other partner agencies. So we've been pushing the campaigns. I mean, goodness, it's been going on for so long now, and it's back in Parliament because we said we would bring it back under the Victims and Prisoners Bill if there had been no improvement. And we have to keep talking about it, Zoe, don't we? Because many people don't understand what we're asking for, but also for you, it's a reality that you are living in, that Jason Smith is now going to be released and we are just weeks away from that release, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's been 10 years we've been talking about it, Laura, and I never thought for one moment when I joined your campaign, I mean, this campaign's been running a lot longer, and when I joined forces with you, I never thought for one moment it would take this long and we would still be here 10 years later and he's now being released. And what's changed? It doesn't feel like a lot's changed. Every time you put the news on, read a paper, we hear more stories that have the same pattern of offences and the police response the same. You know, we'll learn our lessons, they never do. And they're serial offenders and they should have been known to police. They were preventable. It's beyond frustrating.
Yes, and you're living it. I mean, I am incredibly frustrated by it. For me, it's not a reality that my safety is in jeopardy, but for you, it is. And we've been talking about it for a long time. We've had lots of people join us on the campaign. And yes, for me, it started when I worked at New Scotland Yard, when I started profiling domestic violence offenders. And I've talked on Crime Analyst about that work. I found that so many of them were serial perpetrators. And that's really where the genesis of this work came from, of looking at the Metropolitan Police Service's data. That part is so important that it was evidence-based right from the beginning of me saying, well, hang on, why aren't we proactively identifying them? We should actually be looking at identifying 10 to 20 high-risk domestic violence perpetrators and stalkers in the police, and we should be proactively risk managing them, working to safeguard the victim, but to proactively close down opportunities for the offender. And that would mean putting them on VISA, the Violent and Sexual Offenders Database, which is called the Register, VISA with the R, and managing them through MAPA, which is the Multi-Agency Public Protection Arrangements. And that's a statutory process. So I was saying we should be using that statutory process. And I'm still saying that now. And in fact, we had a meeting in Parliament where that was parroted back to me. But we'll come on to that in a moment, because I think what people do really need to understand, that this wasn't just me coming up with an idea. It was actually through many, many cases of looking at 1 in 12 of the domestic violence rapists were raping outside the home, of seeing that 1 in 8 of the DV perpetrators, and I'm shortening it to DV, but domestic abuse, domestic violence perpetrators, 1 in 8 of them were serial perpetrators. These stats are really worrying. And yet, as you say, very little has changed. And I've collected the cases as we've continued on and working with victims and survivors. And I'm still saying in 2024 that we need to make sure that across the country, there's a consistent response and that it's national, because it's no good, for example, if the Metropolitan Police do this and they have the V100 that they're rolling out, which was my work, of identifying the most dangerous men. It's no good if the Met do it, but Devon and Cornwall don't, and the West Midlands Police don't, and Manchester don't, because if he then moves to Manchester, the perpetrator, they're not going to have the same process and system. So we want to have a national database that is consistent to protect victims, so that we ensure that the victim has a proper advocate working with them and risk assessing them for safety and management purposes, safety planning. But there's no good just doing that, loading a victim up with things, if you don't focus on the perpetrator. And it really just, It's not rocket science, this stuff. But Zoe, we've been met with a lot of opposition. And it's really infuriating, that part to it, because this must be rolled out nationally.
Yeah. Honestly, it's so tiring. And I'm just dealing with my own case and my own personal situation. And, you know, obviously I do get contacted by other victims. They listen to my story and people will share their stories with me. And it's really disheartening when you've campaigned so hard for something that everybody that I speak to thinks that this is common sense, or they actually think that it's a thing. You know, they think that if there is a serial perpetrator, they're already tracked and monitored by the police. And they couldn't be more wrong. It's a postcode lottery. And it's got to change. I just feel like, am I saying this again? It's got to change. We know this. I've been saying it for 10 years. It's like, I feel like a hologram of myself, you know, saying the same thing.
And I absolutely echo that. Since 2001, I've been saying this. Yeah. This is the longest running campaign. And that's why it's so infuriating, because I've continued to collect cases and I'm continuing to work with victims who are being left completely vulnerable. And the police still are not joining up the history of the perpetrator. And that's what happened in your case. I mean, we know now that on May the 2nd, Jason Smith will be released. And you and I have had many conversations. We've had to fight continuously for the right things to be done, haven't we? And that's why it's so exhausting for you. There's not just this is mandatory and these things are happening around his risk management. We've really had to fight.
And not just fight right now because it's his release date. Every single year, Laura, since he's been, you know, he was remanded in prison because obviously the level of violence, that was in 2014. He wasn't sentenced until 2015. Then 2016, he appealed. 2017, he appealed again. In 2018, he wrote to you, the smear campaign, wrote to a journalist at the Mirror. 2019, he tried to get early release. And then the whole parole thing. So literally year on year, I've not had peace. Lots of people will say 10 years is not long enough for him. No, I agree with that. But I do think that also 10 years is quite a lengthy prison sentence. When you look at other cases, where often the violence has been worse or the abuse has been over a longer period of time. And then they haven't even got a nowhere near a sentence like that. But, you know, it's we're victims. We're real people with families. This isn't just affecting me. This affects every single person that is close to me in my life. This affects my children, my father, my work. Everything is impacted in some way. You know, whether it's I've had to deal with, maybe I found out that he's appealed. That's triggering. You know, you have to then deal with that emotion and still continue with your everyday life. It's exhausting. And I don't think that when we're talking to people about the problem, and what I've found as well is when I'm talking to professionals about the problem, police in particular, it's like the problem's too big to deal with it. That's not a good enough excuse not to do something about it. Because the amount of money that's in counter-terrorism is eye-watering, the amount of money that they put towards that. When you look at the stats of women that are being murdered, why are we not throwing that amount of money at violence against women and girls? It doesn't make sense to me.
Let's talk about breaking bad habits. We all have them, right? Well, is there something you want to stop doing? Fidgeting, snacking, breaking a hand-to-mouth fixation, like picking or biting the skin around your nails, gnawing on your cuticles, or maybe drumming your fingers or wringing your hands. Idle hands are the devil's playground and all that. Well, my sponsor, Fume, is a breath of fresh air. That's right, Fume. F-U-M. Fume takes your habit and simply makes it better, healthier, and a whole lot more enjoyable. It's not about giving up, it's about switching up. Fume is an innovative, award-winning flavoured air device that does just that. Instead of vapour, Fume uses flavoured air. Instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavours. I think you're starting to get it. Instead of bad, Fume is good. It's a habit you're free to enjoy and makes replacing your bad habit easy. You know, I wasn't sure what to expect, but it tastes much fresher than I thought. Think refreshing herbal tea. There's no vapour, no nicotine, just delicious natural flavoured air. There's no toxins or batteries involved. And it does look pretty cool. Start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/crimeanalyst and get the journey pack today. Fume is giving my lovely listeners 10% off when you use my code crimeanalyst to help make starting the good habit that much easier. There are so many benefits of microdosing, And all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And who doesn't want that in life? I love how helpful these gummies are. For me, half a microdose gummy on the weekend helps me stay centered and fresh as I work out and get everything done on my weekend to-do list. One gummy, about 30 minutes before I go to bed, helps me relax at night and really be present in the moment, instead of worrying about things from that day or thinking about what's coming tomorrow. Get 30% off your first order, plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST, for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. Well, I've always said the same thing. You know, and often when I was in the police, a lot of money would go into the detective side, so the murders. But I kept saying we should be looking at putting that money into skilling up detectives and officers around public protection, preventing those murders. And that's where the Homicide Prevention Unit came from. And I think for you, Zoe, I mean, having been such a, I've been part of your story, and I was so taken with you when you initially said that on the night he tried to kill you, he was not going to take you away from your children. Your mental fortitude, you saved your own life, your quick thinking, everything that you did. And I just thought, wow, this woman is incredible. And you have had to fight every step of the way and been such a warrior in this process. And it's a privilege for me to know you and work with you. And I won't stop advocating on your behalf, because we need strong advocates who really do represent the victim's voice. And I feel that we don't have enough of them. We've been trying to ensure that we've got ISACs, independent stalking advocacy caseworkers, who are accredited by Paladin. They roll out the training, that they are across the country. And we've made a bit of headway there, but we want to make sure it's the offenders that are really focused on around that other part of the coin, which is offender management, closing down their opportunity to offend. And I have to say, Jason Smith was given so many opportunities to carry on. Every time West Mids failed to properly investigate, failed to join up his history, they let a woman down. Well, he was stalking a police officer that he'd had a relationship with, and that was diluted to harassment, and he did go to prison, and it was one of their own, and still they failed whenever you called. And because he's got the gift of the gab, right? This guy's got the gift of the gab. So he keeps talking professionals round and down. And that's why even when he went to prison, we had to keep fighting to keep him in. He hadn't even served a third of his sentence and he was about to come out. He'd been writing, as you said to me, the CEO of Paladin, to Darvo you. So he was trying to deny and discredit, and he was trying to reverse the victim offender role, even though he was in prison for trying to kill you. I mean, it's so absolutely mind-boggling, and I really want people to understand that, that for you, you were first, well, West Mids police wanted to interview you because he had got his father to make a report that you were harassing him. And at that point, West Mids police did act and they wanted to bring you in under voluntary interview. It's just laughable if it weren't so serious, but this is serious because it's your life. It's your children, it's your family. And I'm so sick of having to fight so hard when this stuff should just be automatic, right? It should just be automatic. And that's what we're trying to ensure. And we shorthand the campaign to the Register, but it's all these things that become automatic, that you get an ISAC, then the offender management part kicks in because it's automatic and mandatory, right? It's not too much to ask. And when you look at, you know, each murder that costs now £3 million to investigate before a trial, it saves money as well as saving lives. You know, it's just common sense stuff. As you say, when you have the ability to explain it to someone, people get it and then become supporters of it. But there's some who don't get it, who are fighting for it not to come in. And that's at the expense of victims.
Yeah, I mean, there's 276,000 signatures on the petition now. I mean, it's the next goal is 300,000 signatures. And that's a huge number. of people that have took the time to sign it, and so many comments in there of people that have been affected by serial offenders that are known to police. And just the fact that we're still having this conversation, and time again, we thought that it was being brought in, but then it got brought in guidance or in a different guise.
Well, some of the wins that we did get, I mean, they are now doing, the coercive controllers who've served 12 months or more will go on Visor and they will be managed under MAPA. But that's only a tiny portion, bearing in mind that only 1% of coercive controllers are convicted. Yeah. But at the very minimum, we want stalkers matched on that, right? So that stalkers who are convicted, and right now it's 1.4% of stalkers are convicted. So those who are, we want them to go automatically on Visor and be managed under MAPA. You're talking about small numbers. So the government should match that under the Victims and Prisoners Bill, which we've currently got going through Parliament. At the very least, they should match that. Because there are men like, do you remember the case of Bryce Hodgson, who was recently shot dead by police? He was trying to break into the victim's house. Do you remember this case? It was in Southwark, and he was shot dead. He had on his person crossbows. Yeah. He had a knife and he had an axe. He was dressed in black. And at 5 a.m., he was trying to go through her door. And he had previously been arrested for breaking into her property and appearing in her bedroom talking about raping her. This is the most dangerous kind of stalker. And yeah. Yet, what happened at court? It was diluted and plea bargained out so that he was spared prison because of his previous good character, in inverted commas, even though there's a history with him. He got a 12-month supervision order and 120 hours community service and a restraining order. And the second charge of breaking his bail was dropped by the CPS. And then he escalated to try and kill her. Well, he was shot dead by police because he threatened police at that address. So they shot him dead. He should have gone on that register, someone like him, yeah. And should have been convicted. So there's the argument about ensuring that stalkers are convicted and that their sentences are not lenient. But you've also got those who are unconvicted, because we know that only a small percentage of them are being arrested and prosecuted. And so therefore, when we get those individuals, we also want them to be managed under Category 3 of MAPA, and that it's automatic when you've got two or more victims. Now, that's important for it to become mandatory, because the guidance, you alluded to guidance, Zoe, and we know the last time all of this was debated under the Domestic Abuse Act and the bill as it was going through Parliament, government refused to make it automatic and they said that they would improve upon the guidance for Category 3 and make sure it's clear that stalkers and domestic abusers should be considered under Category 3, should be considered. Right, rather than mandatory, which is what we want. Well, just to give you a stat, at that time, we looked at the statistics for MAPA, Category 1, which tends to be sexual offenders, Category 2, which is violent offenders sentenced to 12 months or more, and Category 3 is other dangerous offenders, right? So they may not be convicted. They could be non-convicted, but they're complex cases that require an active interagency management by senior managers. And we looked at the statistics. So Category 1 had 60,000 offenders that are managed at MAPA. So they're deemed to be the most dangerous, right? Category 2, 20,000. Category 3, 330.
Wow.
Yeah, that number showed that there was a problem. And it should be about 50,000 under Category 3. Right, for domestic violence and stalkers, domestic violence perpetrators and stalkers, it should be about 50,000. That shows you the gap. And yes, it takes resources. And we've said that to government very clearly. But the resource, if you're having to shell out, you know, £1,000 every time a victim calls out, and maybe they call the police 10 times, so you've got 10,000. And then if they're killed, which has happened in multiple cases, that's another 3 million plus the trial. It's a false economy, and we have to make it make sense. So yes, the government have said, this was in the recent debate under the Victims and Prisoners Bill, they said, well, since the guidance came in, there's been a 37% increase under Category 3. Well, that's great, but it's still not good enough, quite frankly. That's the gap that we need to make sure for your case, for Alexis Flavin, for Holly Bramley, who was murdered, for Katie Higton, who was recently murdered in West Yorkshire along with her partner Stephen Harnett by Marcus Osborne. She had reported she was being stalked and he was going to kill her on the Saturday. He murdered her on the Monday. Police arrested him, bailed him. He had a very long history, Zoe. He had, I think it was something like, let me just check my notes, 12 previous convictions and 27 offences. Well, 2011, he was jailed for 16 weeks for assaulting his girlfriend. He strangled her and punched her. In 2010, he served a 54-month jail term for GBH on a woman who he'd only known for 2 weeks. He punched her and kicked her in the head. He very violent offences, and yet West Yorkshire police arrest him and bail him. This has to be automatic. These men should be being managed under Category 3 MAPA, and it must be automatic. That's the reality. And the numbers are really worrying that we've just got this massive gap, and that's what we're trying to close.
Frightening.
It's a resource issue. I mean, the government, people always ask me, well, why do you think you're getting pushback more recently? And I think that they balk at the number that should be closer to 50,000. You can't have the tail wagging the dog. And I've always said this with risk assessment. Just by burying your head in the sand, that doesn't mean the problem goes away. Well, you have to find, right, the money to resource it. And if there's a 3 million spend at every murder, excluding the trial, that's a huge amount of money. And in the Met, where we had this working, we had the Dash being used, we had the Marrick, the multi-agency meetings for the perpetrators, and we reduced murder by 58% for 13 years for domestic violence, which is 33 people less dead every year. We proved the concept. We not only did it, we proved the concept. We know that it works, and it is about ensuring the right response. But burying your head in the sand and saying, okay, well, we'll tweak the guidance, which they did, we'll upgrade the database. They only agreed to upgrade Visor to MAPS because of our campaign. Yeah. They created a perpetrator strategy because we pushed for it. So we did get some wins, but we said at the time, it's not the main win that we're after, which is why we're bringing it back to Parliament, and it will be debated again on the 23rd of April. And it's so important that people understand what we're doing and why we're trying to do it, and support this process. And people can sign the petition and can write to their MPs. So it's no good just updating guidance. You have to do all of the things so that you're not left there as a victim having to fight the process at every stage. And one thing that really struck me, Zoe, I still remember with your case that his lawyer argued at court that he was of previous good character and there was no previous history, right? Do you remember that?
Yes.
It really stuck out to me.
And it's like, well, he's got a history. Where is the good character?
Yeah, so if this had come in, that lawyer would not be able to argue that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I've always said it, I wouldn't be sat here talking to you today, Laura, if that was a thing, because we wouldn't have been in a relationship. And that very first 999 call that I made, he would have been dealt with the level of risk that he posed. So either he would have been kept away from me with an order, or I would have been told about his previous convictions, meaning that I could keep myself safe. But none of that happened. I was told time and time again that basically I was a nuisance, nothing had happened, and I should call back when he does something. So you're a sitting duck. And I don't think a lot has changed. That story is the same for the victims. The police don't respond and don't get it. And I think we've got a real problem that they talk about all this 20,000 new recruits they've got. Well, that's fantastic, but they know nothing. What about all of the experienced police officers that we've lost because they no longer want to work in the police? Because actually now the reputation is so bad because the leadership is a problem. Because let's face it, the laws that they're working with and the leadership that's been pushed down onto them. So you can probably tell in my voice, I mean, you know, before I'd get quite passionate and everything about it, now I'm quite deflated and just think, is it going to change? When is it going to change? Do they care? I don't think they do. And people who are briefing against what is common sense seems utterly diabolical, because I think that everybody that's working in the sector of violence against women and girls should be working together for the right outcome. And that's for the good of the victims. And how can nothing have changed in 10 years? Just boggles my mind. If we think about what the world was like 10 years ago, there's been lots of evolution in other areas. Yet here we are saying the same things. It's really difficult. And it's more real for me now because of the release date, because actually I've been able to talk quite freely in the 10 years that he's been behind bars. Now it feels like, am I safe? Can I talk as freely? But I probably will, because that is kind of my nature. But I just feel like it is very real, and I do have to think more about what I'm talking about, you know. And it's like I have had to make changes in my life, but I'm not going to talk about that here, because there is no doubt that he will be listening to this episode, because that's what they do. I mean, he knew lots of things, even from behind bars. He was even able to contact me from behind bars right at the beginning, because he got done for the witness intimidation. So even when they're behind bars, you're not safe. So that feeling of there is a level of safety with him being locked up, even though we had to fight to keep him behind bars, is being removed. And now I've got to rely on license conditions. And quite frankly, I don't have any faith in the system. And that's a sad thing to say.
Hey, lovely listeners. I'm jumping in here because I know many of you want to learn more about analysing behaviour and the risk factors for serious harm and homicide, as well as for suicide and familicide regarding domestic abuse, stalking, sexual violence, so-called honour-based abuse and coercive control. The good news is that I'm running new masterclasses, which anyone can attend, on the 30th of May, and then I'll repeat the class again on the 18th of October. You've asked and I've listened, and I'm really excited to meet you all in these classes. There will also be two different time slots on each day to allow for those who are in Australia and in the UK and America and in other parts of the world. I'm also running new domestic abuse, stalking and harassment and so-called honour-based violence risk identification, assessment and management masterclasses on the 12th and 13th of June. And I'll be repeating the masterclass again on the 30th and 31st of October for those who work with victims. Learning how to risk assess and advocate for victims, including developing safety plans, as well as ensuring you do appropriate offender risk management, is proven the most effective way to save lives and protect victims. And if you want to be DASH trained and accredited to train others, the DASH Train the Trainer will be on the 19th and 20th of June, and I'll be running it again on the 14th and 15th of November. I'm also leading coercive control masterclasses on the 10th and 11th of July, and the second date is the 4th and 5th of December. You know, these masterclasses really are life-saving and life-changing, and I guarantee that if you attend, you'll have many lightbulb moments throughout. And just to reiterate, the masterclasses on the 30th of May and the 18th of October are available for anyone to attend, and they will be virtual classes. For more information, go to my website, www.thelaurarichards.com, www.-riskchecklist.com, or you can email Amanda on laurarichardspa@gmail.com. I look forward to seeing you in my virtual class, you lovely lot. Yes, and I totally understand why you feel that way, because we have had to fight tooth and nail. I mean, when he wrote to me, the things, firstly, it was that he was obviously scanning who you were talking with, and he'd seen that we had spoken out in the Mirror and various other places. So it's that sense that, for me, the minute I told you that I'd received this letter, I was communicating the message for him to you.
Right. Yeah.
I'm still watching you. I still know what you're doing. Then when I communicated the content of the letter, it's again doubly devastating, because you're being painted as the problem, even though that's really what was breathtaking to me. And what I see in a lot of the cases is just how plausible these guys can be, and that many people get taken in by them. And of course, I didn't, but then I had to advocate to the police of why this was a continuation of the stalking, which they would not accept. Mm-hmm. And that's how tough it is, that even as the CEO of Paladin, who knows stalking inside and out, who campaigned for the stalking law, helped write it with the Home Office lawyers and the points to prove, you still got a police officer saying, no, it's not stalking. And this third party stuff, the by proxy, is rarely ever, in my professional experience, taken into account. It's rarely ever, and I can't think of one case where it's seen as a continuation of the stalking and an arrest is made. Often it's just the police officer will basically say, oh, well, it's his right to say A, B or C, rather than actually, no, he's using me to get to Zoe. That's what he was doing. He did the same with the journalist and he continues to do those things. That's how insidious it is. And so for you, and I'm just trying, I know you know this, Zoe, I'm just trying to explain it so other people really get it.
Yeah.
It's so insidious, that Darvo process, and yet it's never taken into account with the behaviour. And he's been doing these things from prison. And you and I talked about how we communicate in this episode because we know he will listen to this. And therefore, my primary aim is about safeguarding you and your family. But what it also tells people is that it never ends for you. You constantly have to regulate yourself. You constantly have to think about what you put out there. You're not putting much out online. And I hear this from stalking victims all the time. They feel they cannot go online because they're being monitored, they're being watched, and therefore that limits them in being able to behave freely and do the things. Let's say you're an online influencer. You then have to stop. You have to stop doing the things that could bring you revenue or that bring you joy or allow you to connect with other people. And it just never ends. There's these new risks that come out every time there's a change in status for him. And we've been fighting behind the scenes. I've been speaking to lots of people, including the victims commissioner, about your case. And everyone feels incredibly frustrated that there was a drive by prison and probation staff to release him early. And we've had to get that stopped. Well, we got that stopped because you're connected to some influential people. But what about the victims who are not connected to influential people? And it was the same in Tracy Morgan's case. The only reason why Burstow didn't come out of prison was because she was connected at the ACPO, the MPCC working group on stalking.
Yeah.
And what about all the other victims that don't have that level of connection?
I say that a lot, actually, Laura. I say that a lot. Whenever I'm talking to anybody, I say, my story isn't unique. I just have a voice to be able to articulate it to people that will listen. And I believe that it was the photo, the horrific injury picture that platformed my story, because people could see physically what had happened to me. And they found that the most shocking part. But I mean, that isn't the most shocking part, because actually what you deal with, the aftermath, even the run up to that, that's just one small part of it. That was the horrific violence. But then the whole journey afterwards, having to fight the system and constantly retell your story and make people understand it's not over yet and it's still not over now. It's life changing.
And why should your life continue to be impacted by someone you want left way behind in the past? That's what I get frustrated about for you. You just want this to end, but yet there's this constant triangulation, and it has to be a mandatory process so that you don't have to keep using that time and energy to fight the system. And that's what we're after. I mean, Jason Smith will be managed under Category 3. So Category 3 of MAPA for the most dangerous of convicted or unconvicted offenders who are capable of causing serious harm and require a multi-agency management response because they're the most complex of cases. So senior managers must be involved. And as I always say, if they pose such a risk, why the hell are they being released?
Yeah, absolutely.
But we're having to fight it on so many levels. I mean, I was involved in the fight to keep Colin Pitchfork behind bars and Robert Brown, who killed Joe Simpson. I've been involved in many cases that behind the scenes, and some of them my amazing listeners have been involved with. And I know many of you lovely lot have been writing to your MPs. You've sent me the letters that have come back and you've also signed the petition. You've been promoting what we've been saying online. So please keep doing all of that. But we still need to drive this home. We want to make sure that the Jason Smiths there are many more of them are just managed automatically, and that the Zoes and other victims don't have to spend all this time and energy having to literally fight to survive and have your voice heard. But the other part, Zoe, that I wanted to talk with you about, because it's part of this story, is about Claire's Law. Because I keep seeing people say, well, we don't need this because we've got Claire's Law. And I have to keep saying it doesn't work.
No, because I would never have used Claire's Law. You know, I never recognised that I was a victim at the time, because I just thought I was in a relationship and he had unravelled and he was the problem. But I didn't think I was in danger. I didn't know I was in danger. I had no idea that he was a domestic abuser. And I didn't, there was no way of me ever knowing that. And I wouldn't have gone to the police. You don't go into a relationship and then start going to the police and asking for a background check. It would only be probably people like myself who have already been through it. You know, after going through domestic violence, you may well use Claire's Law. But I think somebody who's never had any kind of dealings with domestic violence or domestic abuse, they're not going to go and do that. It also puts the onus on them. And more often than not, I don't think they actually even get the information from the police, which is what I get back from a lot of victims. So I'll say, you know, you have a right to go and get Claire's Law. And then they'll go and do the Claire's Law and go, oh, sorry, it was refused. Well, you know, well, what's the point then if it gets refused?
Yes, I have a lot to say about Claire's Law, having been part of bringing it in. And people might not know, but Claire's Law came from Claire Wood's horrific murder in 2009. And you probably remember it, Zoe. I certainly do, that Claire Wood met George Appleton online and she didn't know all about his history. But she suffered horrific abuse and he escalated to rape and strangulation, and he murdered her and set her on fire. Well, her father, after she was murdered, Michael Brown, he campaigned and lobbied for the police to join up the histories of violent men. So it was going to be a News of the World campaign, and I was part of that. Michael Brown was an incredible man. He was also a former prison officer. Did you know that, that he was a former prison officer? And when he met George Appleton, he knew he was a wrong'un, right?
Yeah.
He was on his radar and he knew that he was not a good guy. And he did, in fact, have a history of violence. He'd been jailed for 3 years in 2012 for stalking another woman and breaching a restraining order of another woman. One of the things that always stayed with me was that Michael said, and he's now, he died very sadly not long ago, but he basically said that he had this beautiful daughter, but not only that, he's stolen the most, and I'm going to quote him, he has stolen the most precious thing of all, a mother to my granddaughter, because Claire had a child. Yeah. And the legacy was Claire's Law, and there's two arms to it, right to ask and right to know. So the right to ask arm is, as you've described, that a victim can ask the police, and it's normally when something's happened, about the history. The MPCC, which is the Chief Officers Group, they looked at data between October 2021 and March 2022, and they found that at least 56% of requests by victims were denied, i.e. they were sent away. Now, I have anecdotal data when women have asked, they've been told things like, we're not a dating agency service here. We don't just do background checks just because you fancy it, right? They're being told things like that. Wiltshire Police have shown spectacular failures. The chief officer there, and I do take my hat off to her, but she looked at 3,500 applications that had been made, and she found that there were 25 very serious failures where information was not shared with the victim, and at least two women were seriously harmed as a consequence of that. And every police force should be looking at their own data, right? So the right to ask doesn't work. And for me, the government right now and various charities are pushing to get Claire's Law out there to say you've got a right to ask. But why should the burden be on the victim? That for me is just another way to load up the victim of something that they need to do. Now, the other arm is right to know. And that's where the police can give that information. But what we know is they're just not. They're just not proactively identifying the offenders. And there was just a piece, there was a BBC News article on April the 9th where it was talking about Claire's Law, because there's been this big push for Claire's Law recently, I'd noticed. And there was a lady called Danielle who had spoken out. Now, that's a pseudonym. But she had basically met her partner through work, and 6 months into the relationship, he abused her. And he basically strangled her, grabbed her by the throat, and smashed her head against the wall. So a very serious offence. And she screamed for help. She spoke to a social worker afterwards who told her to do a Claire's Law request, right to ask. Well, the next day, the police arrived at her door and they told her that he had a record for violent assaults on 20 other women.
Wow.
20 other women. Now, police should have had him on their radar. It shouldn't have taken her to ask the question. That's what we're trying to change, to make sure, right, that the police have these men on their radar and it's not incumbent upon the victim to ask. We load the victim up, you know this, Zoe, with all these things they're meant to do. And then we say, oh, well, she didn't ask, which is what happened in Alexis Flavin's case. Oh, well, she didn't ask. And when she did ask, we told her, but it's, why aren't they just doing it? The other cases I wanted to make mention of, because I've been looking at a lot of them, are Holly Bramley's horrific murder by her husband, Nicholas Metzen. This case is just awful, Zoe. She was stabbed to death by him, but he then cut her up into 200 pieces and disposed of her body in the River Witham in March last year. Now, he had prior convictions for violence against former partners in 2013, 2010 and 2017. So he had all this history.
Of what we know.
Yeah, of what's known about. Well, of course, there'd be others, because we know that these serial perpetrators, I mean, he got a 19-year sentence for that. And another guy, his mate, Joshua Hancock, helped him dispose of her. I mean, that's a whole other thing about, I've worked, well, been involved with a number of cases now where the perpetrator has called up a bromate and they've helped either in the commission of the murder or the disposal of the female victim, which is just staggering to me.
Yes. Like,
that talks to me about misogyny. And, you know, I just find these cases so bothersome because they're preventable.
Yes.
If this was happening, and I still wonder, Zoe, if it had come in when we had first asked, how many women's lives would have been saved? How many children would have been saved? How many women wouldn't have been harmed?
Yeah.
Because they were told about the history and didn't continue in the relationship.
Yeah. A huge number. The impact of, I always say, right data, right time. They don't have the right data at the right time. You know, it's, and West Midlands Police, right back when it first happened to my, in my story, they said, well, we do collect data on serial perpetrators. Yeah, but collecting the data is one thing. If you're not doing anything with it, it may as well be a book on a shelf. It's just pointless, you know. So it's what they do with that information and how they react.
Yeah, and they have the DASH risk model. I gave them a mechanism to identify these perpetrators. So the practical side is, the Metz V100, do you remember when we went into Parliament and we went and had a meeting with Jess Phillips and she said, have you heard about the V100 of what the Met are doing? And I said, oh, it sounds like a Virgin flight because I've just flown in from the US. And she said, oh, the Met are doing this great initiative of identifying the top 100 violent men. And I said, oh, what I was doing in the Met that's in various articles in the Times with Lucy Bannerman. Yeah. I did a piece in the Evening Standard that we are identifying the top 100. And she said, yeah, that's it. And I said, well, that's old. I mean, we were doing that before, but I'm glad that they've started doing it again. And I wonder how many lives would have been saved if they'd continued doing it. And they're obviously doing it post Sarah Everard, but we need every police force to do it. And that essentially is the register. If every police force identified the top 10 to 20 violent and serial perpetrators for domestic violence and stalking, they then put them on a database that's national. And then they put them to the mapper under Category 3, the multi-agency public protection arrangements, and they risk manage the perpetrator but safety plan with the victim. Yeah. That essentially is it. And it would be statutory. Yeah. And that's what we're asking for. And that's what will be debated again in the Victims and Prisoners Bill on April the 23rd. And police forces can do this already and should be doing this already.
Yeah.
It's very practical stuff. You know, I've got right next to me the book Policing Domestic Violence that I wrote with two police officers in the Met with all the best practice in. It's the Oxford University Press book. All of this is in there. It's all documented as good practice for the police. And that's why this book is still very much current, although laws have changed, and we want to change the law here to make it mandatory so that it happens. Get it for the convicted offenders, domestic violence offenders and stalkers, and also the unconvicted. And it's all perfectly doable. And yes, it takes resources to do it. Nothing is free. Nothing can be done. But you know this, Zoe, the biggest change that could happen is believing victims when they come forward and taking them seriously and checking the history of the offender. That's the biggest change, and that costs nothing.
And that's also will be the byproduct of bringing in the register, because the culture will naturally change with it, because victims will have to be believed, because there will be the historic pattern of behaviour. Whereas now, every incident's just dealt with in isolation. It's whether or not the police officer believes you.
But you would be corroborated if they check the history.
Yes.
I mean, in the Met, it's the most basic thing. I worked in intelligence. The first thing I would ever do is look at the history on the crime report and on the intelligence database for the victim, for the offender, for the home address, to know what's going on there. Mm. And it's really basic stuff. But that basic stuff's not happening. And if you get the basics right, as Lord Lamming said after Victoria Climbier, the rest will follow. And I'm a big proponent of that. Everything I've done in policing and outside is very practical, because I talk to a lot of police officers and I talk to a lot of victims, and we problem solve how best to do this. So I've spoken to a lot of probation officers, a lot of prison officers, a lot of social workers, and this has come from a grassroots movement with an evidence base of cases. So for the government, improving the guidance for MAPA, particularly around category three, well, it's great there's been a 37% increase in the, you know, 330 offenders that they originally had, but really that's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
We've got to improve upon that. And data, intelligence, advocacy, and offender management, that's what prevents serious harm and homicide. We know that.
Yeah.
Prevent murder in slow motion. So is there anything else, Zoe, that you wanted to say? Anything that we didn't cover?
We still have the outstanding case against West Midlands Police, which is extremely slow and frustrating as well.
That's the lawsuit.
Yeah.
Because of their lack of ability of joining up the history in order to protect you.
Yeah. So that's still ongoing. So there is a lot that I'm dealing with right now. It's a real deflation, honestly. I suppose if you go back and listen to my other episode, you'll hear my passion and my fight and my drive to try and get this change and get, you know, when we originally started talking, Laura, about the register, and I was so positive, you know, that this is going to come in. Look how many signatures. Whenever we talk about it, the signatures on the petition just, they go up because people get it. And that's the way it should be. That says a lot. But then actually nothing changes again. And it's highly frustrating and makes you feel, as a victim of that crime, that no one actually cares, because they've got their own agenda. They're fighting another fight that actually doesn't impact victims. Maybe it does in some way, but why can't we do something that has a big impact for the highest risk? Because they're trying to deal with so much. And that comment that I get all the time, well, the problem's so big. Well, if you are focusing on the V100, you're focusing, at least lives will be saved, because they are going to be lost by those people. So at least we start somewhere. We don't just do nothing. And that's what it feels like they've done in the last 10 years. We've plugged a couple of holes here and there. But really, have we actually made everlasting change? No, I don't think we have.
Hey, lovely. I'm jumping in here because I want to tell you that I'm so happy that you're here. I know Crime Analyst has helped so many of you, and you want to help others. And many of you want to support my work, plus you want deeper engagement with me and with each other, and you want more content. Crime Analyst is much more than a podcast, which is why I am delighted to launch the Crime Analyst Squad on Patreon. You can become a squad member. There are two tiers, squad member and squad ringleader, and you'll receive ad-free episodes released early on the weekend, a guaranteed extra episode a month, behind-the-scenes videos, You'll get my unfiltered two cents regarding cases and the cases that you want me to talk about, extended episodes and interviews, exclusive access to photos, case materials, official documents and summary notes. You'll get my curated list of the best true crime TV shows, docus, books, podcasts and audiobooks, the good stuff that I'm watching, reading and listening to, because let's face it, there's so much true crime content out there. Who's got time to waste? And then we can chat about it, as well as about my episodes in a safe space. And you can join me at a monthly happy hour, because who doesn't love a good happy hour? And in the squad, you can jump the line with early ticket access to my masterclasses, my webinars and events. And I have some free criminal behavioral analysis webinars upcoming on May the 23rd and September the 28th, and masterclasses on May the 30th and October the 18th, which are open to everyone for the first time, which I'm really excited about. You'll also receive sneak peeks about episodes, cases, and my media appearances, and also my campaign work, which I know so many of you want to do more advocacy and become activists, which is hugely exciting. I want to build the Crime Analyst Squad together and change the world. I believe this is the best way to do it, and I'm really excited for the next stage of our journey together. There are still some founder spots available. Just head over to my Patreon, patreon.com/crimeanalyst, where you can sneak preview my extra videos and photos and content. That's patreon.com/crimeanalyst. And I'll see you in the squad, lovely. Yes, it's extremely frustrating. And I think some of the charities brief against because they're empire building. And I'm just saying it as it is, because I'm sick of charities seeing it as a way of getting more funding. And therefore, they brief against what you're saying so that they can create something else for more funding. And, you know, I say that because I've seen it happening, and it's happening right now with the Victims and Prisoners Bill as we go into report stage, as a charity is briefing against what we're trying to do because they are trying to take monopoly in this area. And the politics with a big P and a small P are exhausting. And yeah. I too am sick of that part because it doesn't represent what victims need. They need consistency and national join up. They need to know that the police are being told you must focus on the perpetrators. And that 10 to 20 focusing on the perpetrators of high risk, that will create the biggest step change for victims and cultural change. Yes. And that's for the unconvicted. And you have to deal with the convicted too, because you've got the Bryce Hodgsons who have been convicted, whose history still isn't being joined up. So you have to do the two things together. And look, I don't have any skin in the game. I don't get any funding from doing this. In fact, I've been doing it all pro bono, as you know, writing briefing after briefing. But there are others who are briefing because it benefits them, and counter briefing. And I don't have the time or energy or inclination. And I'm always a direct person. And I just say it as it is. There are some who just want to keep debating it and then kick it into the long grass or counter brief. And I'm sick of that, because the personalities and the politicking have no place here. It doesn't help you. It doesn't help Alexis. It doesn't help any of the victims that I've been speaking to that's going on. And I really want people to be laser focused. We've got case after case of failures. And I've been looking to fix those failures and problem solve it. And I've been doing this for almost 30 years. Well, other people come into charities, first job, fresh out of work, college or whatever. They don't have all that history. And it does matter, because I look at the whites of your eyes, Zoe, and I see that you're depleted and demoralized. But I can tell you that I do care, and I don't give up, as you know. I keep going. Yeah. In the Met, it was one of the things some would say is that I was like a dog with a bone. It was never... was that complimentary? I don't always think it is, but but for me, you know, when I lock onto something and I know it will make a big difference to victims and survivors and families, as John and Penny Clough know, I remain loyal to that cause. So we will keep going. And of course, anything I can do to support you as your advocate and friend, well, absolutely, I will do. And we will keep fighting. We have got, you know, a number of people in Parliament who are fighting for this, who want to protect victims and are heavily invested in that. So I just hope that the government listen this time. Yeah. And equally, if Labour come in, one of the things they are doing is they want the V100. They want every force doing that. And they've made, Yvette Cooper's made some very clear claims for the direction of travel. And of course, they've got Jess Phillips, Stella Creasy. There's a lot of incredible women, Baroness Jam Royal, you know, who've been banging this drum with us for a very long time.
Yeah.
But for you, the reality is May 2nd, and there's no getting away or around that, as you well know.
Exactly. It's all very real yet again. And it comes in waves. But I thought by this point, things would have had some dramatic changes, and they haven't. So we need to push again.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
And I'll continue to advocate for you, Zoe. So I'm going to thank you for your time. And I know this isn't the end of our conversation, but it is for us talking on Crime Analyst. And I know that my listeners will 100% support you. And please do sign the petition. If you haven't, share it with other people. Please do listen to Zoe's episodes on Crime Analyst. And Zoe, you've got a book as well. Do you want to say something about your book?
Yes, Mind Over Manipulators. So I don't actually have a copy to hand, but I can see you've got it in your background there. Laura.
I do. I do have a copy, a signed copy. I'm very lucky.
So that talks about my journey, but I don't just talk about my story. I talk about our campaigning work, Laura. I talk about other cases in there. And it kind of isn't the finished article because the story still hasn't ended. So, you know, watch this space, really.
Yes. And do buy Zoe's book, which they can find. Where's the best place on your website?
Amazon on my website. But I mean, Amazon, everyone can go there and find it. It's in every country in Amazon.
On Amazon. And, you know, do write to your MP. One of my listeners had written to her MP, who's Robert Court, who is also the Solicitor General for England and Wales. And she had written when I first asked, and she pretty much got a fob off letter. But this time she received a letter saying that he was going to follow it up and find out what was going on around the register and serial perpetrators. So I've got some follow-up meetings to be done. And Robert Court, certainly on my radar. There's a number of other people as well. So please do write to your MP. It does make a difference.
It does.
To see where they are and to have questions raised in Parliament about it and to show support. So I'll sign off on that note and say thank you so much, Zoe, and to my listeners, be curious, ask questions, and always trust your instincts. Here's my final thought and ask before the episode wraps. I really appreciate you listening to Crime Analyst, and if you like what I do, please take 2 minutes to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to me. It really helps others find me and my work, and it helps with the ratings too. Crime Analyst is written, produced, and hosted by me, Laura Richards. Sound engineering by Jason Sheesley at Abridged Audio. Cover art and graphics by Chris Rowbottom at Syndicate, and music by Kilrood.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.